Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Brady McCartney, your host today. I'm joined by Jennifer Shepherd Hughes, author of Church of the Dead, The Epidemic of 1576 and the Birth of Christianity in the Americas, published by NYU Press in 2021. Dr. Shepherd Hughes is Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Riverside. Jennifer Shepherd Hughes, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. So to start, would you please tell us a bit about yourself, your scholarly background, and how you became interested in this topic?
Yes. So I am a historian of religion, and I focus on Latin American religion and Latin American Christianity. And within that, I specialize in religion in Mexico, and I have a rather broad sweep. So my work really transcends sort of many centuries and spans from the pre-invasion, before the Spanish invasion, up to the present even. So, and my interest in this subject dates quite far back, I would say. I lived in Latin America as a child and in Brazil in my adolescence, and those experiences with especially living in Catholic communities were very formative to me and how I understand the world.
Just describe the 1576 epidemic. So what regions of the Americas are we looking at? Who was impacted? How many people were impacted? In what ways were they impacted? And how long did it last?
Yes. So this epidemic that I am focusing on in this text kind of comes at the end, you could say, of these waves of epidemic cataclysm in the 16th century. So there are a series of epidemics, beginning obviously with the arrival of Europeans, the arrival of the Spanish. This particular epidemic has its epicenter in Mexico, although there's some evidence to suggest that it really extends even into parts of South America and north into parts of Mexico that today form part of the United States. Over the course of the 16th century, the cataclysmic loss due to colonial violence and epidemic disease brings the population of the Americas from close to 100 million people down to an extraordinarily smaller fraction. In central Mexico, this particular epidemic brings the population of Mexico to its lowest point at that time, reduced from, let's say, greater Mexico, maybe up to 22 million down over the course of the 16th century, culminating in this epidemic, to about 2 million. So it's cataclysmic in scope, and has repercussions that reverberate outward.
Right. So you refer to the Mexican mortandad throughout the book and the cocolisle. And then you use this very evocative phrase or almost sentence that you discovered in your research that, quote, blood emerged from our noses. So if you could sort of describe the mortandad, the cocolisle, and why sort of blood coming from the noses, this very evocative image, really sort of surfaced in your research.
Yes. So the term mortandad is one that appears very strongly in the colonial record from the 16th century, in the Spanish record. And it's a word that's been translated in various ways. The great death, the great dying. I've translated it as a death event. And it's used to describe various waves of cataclysmic death throughout the 16th century, but it's also used to describe specific crises or incidents. The term cocolitzli is a Nahuatl word that is used to describe epidemics throughout the colonial period. That word is really coined after the arrival of Spanish, after the Spanish invasion. Maybe we first see it in the record around the middle of the 16th century in what we might term the sort of first cocolitzli pandemic, and then the pandemic that I look at the as the second pandemic. So this word is a sort of generic word for illness that then takes on specific meaning in relation to this this particular pandemic. The other phrase that appears in indigenous sources relating to this pandemic, this particular epidemic, is this term, this Nahuatl term, we bleed from our noses. And that refers to the kind of final, most distressing symptom, which often was the final symptom before people died from this illness. And there was something very powerful about the collective phrase, right? That this is a collective form of affliction in we bleed from our noses. And so some scholars have suggested that this actually was the most, was the sort of name that was most used by Nahuatl communities, the communities that were suffering from it themselves. And what's also powerful is that you see what I would say are sort of glyphic or pictographic representations in indigenous sources that show indigenous people or individuals bleeding from their nose. And that becomes a sort of pictographic representation of this particular pandemic, this particular epidemic. And the motif of blood then becomes really important to my interpretation and how I'm thinking about this disease, both looking at how blood is represented in indigenous authored sources, and then also looking at how Spanish missionaries are thinking about blood.
Sort of sticking with the mortandad. So how did the mortandad impact the indigenous societies in Mexico, sort of the Spanish colonial societies, and ultimately sort of the ways they interacted?
So one of the things as a colonial, as a historian of colonial Mexico, is that we know as historians that cataclysmic demographic loss was part of what defined these centuries. At the same time, not that many scholars or historians have really tried to examine what that meant for specific communities and how that affected worldviews, religious views, religious practices, epistemologies, ways of understanding who we are as a community, for example, or the course of history, how we relate to the divine or to the sacred. And of course, I brought specifically religious questions to that. So the impact, one of the things I note is that the impact of these periods of loss was so profound that they're actually legible in the geological record. So it's legible in terms of we could say kind of the Earth's surface that kind of it's recorded. The loss is so extreme that it's recorded in the Earth's surface. What it meant for individual communities or for, say, Greater Mexico overall is harder to determine because, in a way, this is a kind of one way of thinking about it, sort of a hyper object, right? It's so huge and so vast that sometimes it's not always legible in say the documentary record. And we have to kind of begin to imagine or piece together what might have meant. I think one of the very important things that historians need to remember, of course, is that that indigenous people continued to be the majority population of Mexico through the colonial period. So even though the loss was pronounced, there are still surviving communities. And that, in fact, even at the beginning of the 17th century, those communities, the population is beginning to recover. So I try to probe in this book how communities tried to reconstitute themselves in the aftermath of crisis and also strategize and plan a future for themselves. So not just trying to hold on to what they had, but actually trying to project themselves into the future. In terms of relations with the Spanish, early in this epidemic, Spanish missionaries especially saw themselves as they saw themselves as protectors, they saw themselves as nurses, they saw themselves as healers. They felt that they had a kind of God-given capacity and vocation to intervene on behalf of indigenous people and mitigate the worst impacts of the disease. One of the things that's noteworthy or that I really worked to come to sort of some interpretation of is the way in which we see indigenous communities and written histories and complaints articulating a sense of abandonment, that the church had abandoned them in a moment of crisis. So as it turns out, the scope of death was so difficult that actually at a certain point, these missionaries began to kind of give up on very shortly, maybe within 2 or 3 months, in terms of providing the kind of frontline nursing care, they began to withdraw from that vocation. And so emerging from that, there's a kind of, I would say, rival vision for the church, what the church is, one that is more Spanish and one that is emerging from indigenous communities. So in the wake of this crisis, these competing visions are very pronounced. And I try to explore the precise nature of those distinct visions.
Yeah, I think you did a great job of that. I have a question later in the interview about how sort of your work has complicated some of these narratives. But before moving too far ahead of ourselves, as you suggested in your last answer, religion is sort of central to this book. And while Christianity certainly is sort of the dominant religion that is discussed, it's certainly not the only. And obviously, Christianity is a broad term, right? It doesn't necessarily describe much of what you studied. So what kind of religion or religions were forged during this epidemic, during this demographic catastrophe? You make some allusions to sort of the settler church. But you also obviously talk a lot about how indigenous sort of lifeways, religions, how they interacted with sort of Spanish Catholicism in pretty profound ways that one can still sort of see the remnants of even today.
Yes, one of the questions that really has driven my work for more than two decades is the process by which people throughout Latin America who were subject to European invasion and imperial rule, the process by which they labored upon this imposed religion, right, labored upon Christianity to make it something that was usable, to make it something that was to them sacred or holy or powerful. And in my work, I've try to document that labor, which is a labor of centuries, because of course every generation has to reanimate the religion, right? It's to sustain it, to redefine it, to rework it so that it continues to be relevant and meaningful. And so my work has really tried over, in different periods of time, including the present, to make visible that labor. And so I'm more interested, for example, in the labor of indigenous Catholic communities, say, communities that understand themselves to be Catholic, and their labor, their religious labor as Christians, than I am, for example, in Spanish missionary labor, right? So I sort of shift that lens and that site of agency, you could say religious agency, somewhat. I think that we see in Mexico, of course, every part of Latin America, these dynamics are different, and in different subject communities have different relationships to Christianity, and there are communities that are there are communities that discern in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries that Christianity has no, there's no possible redemption of that. There's nothing, they discern that there's nothing usable or nothing sacred within that religion. In most of central Mexico, in the places where this book is situated, most communities saw fairly immediately that there was resonance. They recognized sacred power in Christianity and then built continuity or a kind of integrated continuity from their own existing cosmological views, their own ontologies, their own epistemologies, so that they, but they discerned that there were parts that needed to be rejected, parts of this imposed religion that were not at the service of holy and sacred things, and they discerned that there were parts of it that were quite powerful and significant, so that resonated. But even then, still perhaps needed some work, right? Or needed to be altered. So one of the things I'm showing is that, and I think you see this throughout the colonial period, but again, in a moment of crisis like this cataclysmic devastation become even more pronounced, is a sort of conflicting or contest over who dictates the practice of Christianity, whether it's Spanish missionaries, priests, or bishops, or whether it's elders, indigenous elders, say, in Mexican Catholic pueblos de indios. So that contest, I think, becomes pronounced, especially pronounced in moments of crisis, and especially, an epidemic, a crisis of that scale, creates the possibility for real tectonic shifts. I think we see that even in the last few years, the way that things can be thrown open at the same time that there's this pushback to kind of re-entrench certain systems and structures and powers. So I think that there's a way that this particular crisis and this pandemic opened up religious possibilities and opened up room for pueblos de indios to assert a certain authority or reassert their authority over Christian practice, but cast very much in indigenous terms. So at the end of this text, as you'll see, it ends with a church that's under the guardianship of indigenous principales or leaders in local communities.
Yeah, this sort of reminded me of some of what I've studied in like Chimayo in New Mexico, where you have this Catholic church that has this long history of pilgrimage, and at different points the Catholic Church either chose not to send priests from the Spanish Empire, if you will, to lead the church, and therefore sort of indigenous folks in the area who had sort of come to see themselves as Catholic, they sort of had to sort of take the leadership role in that context.
So that certainly had some resonances since I focus a bit more on, I guess, North America. But what are you to do when sort of the structure of this this larger entity, you know, sort of Spanish Catholicism, doesn't necessarily send all the resources to show you what, you know, how they think of the religion, how they want you to interpret it, right? It opens up, as you said, quite a few possibilities to sort of refashion in ways that are usable, as you said, or, you know, resonate a bit more for your particular context.
Yeah. I mean, I think also, you know, there was obviously sort of in different points of the history of Latin America, the sort of lack of clergy, right? And especially because it was not possible for indigenous or African descended people to become clergy for part of the colonial period. And so there was this shortage of clergy. At the same time, in Mexico, there's even when clergy are present, there can often be quite a bit of sort of conflict, right, over who determines. So in my work, I've sort of seen that in Mexico, the conflict is less about whether or not communities are going to become Christian, but what it means, what constitutes Christianity, what the parameters of Christianity are, and who's in charge of it. So you have communities who have very conflictual relationships with priests. You have communities who are driving priests out. You have priests who say, I can't work here anymore, right? So it's a shortage, but it's also, I would say, even something more active in terms of what's coming from many of these communities who continue to insist that they knew how Christianity was supposed to be practiced, and knew and were already expert in their relationship with the sacred, right? So they already understood what sort of rituals were significant or important. They knew what it was to engage with religious images, for example, right? And so they bring an authority, and they assert that authority, and that you can imagine sometimes created conflict or made things difficult for the clergy who felt that to become Christian was to become a Spanish Christian, right? And it had that sort of cultural dimension to it as well.
Sure, and that relates to my next question, because it's you can't really talk about sort of Spanish Catholicism without talking about sort of the Spanish imperial project or colonial project. So you talk a bit about sort of the idea of creating sort of a Christian utopia in the Americas. And I'm wondering if you could talk about sort of how the Mortandad, sort of the Great Death, sort of impacted the colonial project, this utopian ideal. And something that stood out to me that I had not read before, but makes sense once you read it. You talked a bit about how sort of observers of the Mortandad, you know, they thought that the epidemic might actually sort of be the end for Christianity in the Americas. It might actually, you know, sort of the introduction of Christianity sort of mixing with this great death event might actually lead people to sort of move away from Christianity, whether indigenous or Spanish, because, you know, you certainly have many accounts represented in this book of, you know, Spanish Catholics, you know, officials, monks, etc., who also were dramatically impacted personally, emotionally, by seeing so much death and by sort of over time recognizing the role that they may be playing in that.
Mm. Yes. So there's been a fair amount kind of written and some very definitive studies on the idea of a sort of millennial Franciscan millennial kingdom in the quote new world, right? So there is a sense among the first generations of missionary friars coming to the Americas that sort of Christianity was in a sense in need of a renewal, of a dramatic renewal, that European Christianity had become compromised and corrupt, and that the quote unquote discovery of the Americas and the people who lived there represented this possibility for a new beginning. And the fantasy, it's I would say Spanish imperialism, Spanish colonialism is obviously quite different than British Protestant colonialism in the Americas. The Spanish, their intention was to create, their primary purpose was to create an indigenous church that was under Franciscan rule or under mendicant rule, and ultimately under Spanish Catholic rule, right? And so this was a utopian vision, and I write about the Corpus Mysticum, the body of Christ, this idea that the body of Christ was altered and expanded, that it was expanding to include indigenous people in the Americas, and that this was a body to which Spanish Christians and Franciscans belonged, and it was a body that was to be kind of an infinite expanding body of new indigenous Christian subjects who were going to be, it was a shared body, and ultimately a body that also mirrored or was the body of the literally reflected the body of Christ also. And that is for the Spanish, a utopian vision, right? And a utopian Christian vision. That vision, I think you see dimensions of it throughout it persists to some extent. It doesn't completely go away throughout the colonial period. But after so many waves of death, like we could say this is the pandemic I'm looking at, sort of third or fourth major period of population decline in the 16th century, some of those original, the oldest missionaries, we could say, like those who had been from the beginning in Mexico, those who had spent almost their entire lives and were now quite older, they felt that with this particular epidemic, that Christianity in itself had come to its end in the quote New World, in the Americas, that really there were not enough people remaining. There's real strong you could say missionary despair. There's also plenty of persistence, right? There's all kinds of the dynamics in the church are complicated, but there's also a very palpable sense of despair in missionary writings from this period. And we see one of the most famous missionaries of the 16th century in Mexico, Sahagún, Bernardino de Sahagún, saying, "I've lived through epidemics here. I've myself was sick in the last one, but we come to this, and there's no future. There's no road. There's no path for the church remaining in Mexico, and it's best now that we move on to the Philippines, to Asia, to China." And they say that really that's where the future of the church is. So you see this this sort of despair, and actually you see it being in the archive is very powerful, because in the midst of these letters about the pandemic, you also see sort of missionary letters about the epidemic. You also see this sort of newly emerging, forming mission to Philippines, right? It's right there. So it's from this crisis that now Mexico becomes more of a launching pad for mission to Asia, and a place, the sort of staging ground for that. And, you know, obviously there, I write about priests and bishops in this book who, after this epidemic, kind of go about the work of continuing to move the church forward, and with their vision of how the Catholic Church in the Americas can continue to survive. But I take very seriously that sense that actually it was over, and that this was a moment of crisis for the history of Christianity in the Americas. And I take seriously that sense. You know, I think it's very easy in retrospect to feel that Christianity was somehow inevitable because of the violent force of imposition of European rule. But actually, throughout the 16th century, there was a sense among the Spanish of precarity, of this is a fragile thing, this is a vulnerable thing. And we see that in this epidemic crisis really come to its maximum articulation. And so I explore and probe that idea of sort of this crisis and then look at the visions that emerge in terms of what a future American Christian church might look like.
Yeah, it's easy to, especially, 500 years later, give or take, to view the Catholic Church as this sort of steamrolling entity, just bringing Christianity to the people, whether they wanted it or not. But I think the picture you paint is far more nuanced. And I think we discussed off air Bishop Medina Rincon, and sort of how he very clearly said he was struggling as somebody in the New World, but also he was really struggling with the colonial project and wanted to return to Spain and sort of wanted to live a more cloistered life in which he felt that Christianity was actually doing the work that I think he had signed up for. So yes, I appreciated the nuanced picture because, it is so easy to just reduce these extremely complex histories into, sort of simplified narratives of, colonize, colonizer, conqueror, etc. And I certainly understand the impulse, but I'm not always sure that's helpful to actually understanding what happened during these time periods.
Yes, I Medina Rincon, who's the Bishop of Michoacan in the midst of this crisis, he emerges to me also as a very interesting kind of historical figure, because he seems, one of the things that was interesting to me actually is even as these missionaries, missionary writers, Christian theologians and priests are sort of, they bemoan the epidemic, they blame colonial violence, they kind of point fingers, but they rarely see themselves as culpable. And that sort of sense of complicity, I think, is very much a modern kind of positionality, right? Vis-a-vis history and the self, perhaps, right? And so, but Medina Rincon seems to have this, he has this sort of really radical sense of there was a right way to do this Christian evangelization and there was a wrong way. And he writes to the king, I've written you so many times and I've told you this is a disaster happening here in terms of exploitation and violence and now look, everyone is dying from this disease. And he says, no one listens to me. And so just let me go back to Spain. There's nothing left here. This is irretrievable. So he has this kind of distant kind of critique that I think even Bartolomé de las Casas, who's the famous critic of colonial violence, Spanish critic in the same period or in this period, he never comes to quite that sense, right? He remains invested in the project, whereas Medina Rincon is like, I don't want to be part of this. It's too broken. There's no way out of this. And there's, of course, another bishop, archbishop, who you meet here, who's the opposite, sort of fully complicit and fully aligned with the imperial vision. So you see that range even in terms of the Spanish.
Yeah, the way you wrote Medina Rincon, he really came across as sort of the conscience of the Spanish Catholic Church in Mexico and in the Americas. And Las Casas, I don't know that many histories of the Americas, certainly Spanish and sort of indigenous interactions would be able to be written without his work. But sometimes I think he's credited in a way that maybe somebody like Rincon should be credited as like truly understanding, sort of what was going on during these times in a way that shows a deep self-awareness of sort of the project they were all involved with.
Yes, I see that, and I saw that in Medina Rincon's writing. That he saw that the church was so kind of compromised. I feel that. I don't want to sort of be anachronistic too, and what I'm attributing to him, but but he does seem to recognize that the church is sort of complicit and compromised with the kind of imperial project in such a way that it doesn't have the capacity to extricate itself, right? That these are, I see that in his actions and in his, and of course, he's never released from his bishopric. He's never released, and he dies in Michoacan.
He does indeed. So this makes me think of, I guess, the portion of the book where you write about sort of hospitals, medical care, physical healing, as opposed to sort of the spiritual healing that is discussed throughout the book, and how, you know, the medical care, these hospitals that the Spanish sort of provided to communities, indigenous communities, that they were in some ways only necessary because of the mortandad, and they were sort of a response to sort of this other element that the Spanish had brought into these communities. And I'm wondering how you think of sort of the role of hospitals and medical care provided by the Spanish to these communities, because that's definitely sort of a complex issue, because, you know, in some ways, I think you make the argument that the existence of these hospitals and, you know, these medical providers saved a number of folks from death in indigenous communities. And again, would they be as necessary if the Spanish had not sort of arrived in the way that they did with, obviously, the sort of Colombian exchange, if you will?
Right. I think one of the things that's really obvious looking at this period is that the Spanish, this first European colonial project in the Americas, is a modern project. The Spanish wanted the sort of, they've deployed medicine, technology, scientific knowledge at the service of this imperial project, right? And they wanted there to be the most sort of advanced hospitals on this landscape of the Americas. And at the same time, right? It's also sort of part of that missionary project as well. And one of the things I say is I have this sort of, you know, sort of hypothesis that in a way the church had been losing its control over hospitals to some extent in Europe at this time, in the sort of spirit of modernization. But yet in Mexico, they actually resumed more total control over hospitals. And they are sort of necessitated by this ongoing health emergency that imperial rule has wrought, right? And, you know, and there's some of those hospitals that are more solidly under Spanish control, but there are also in Michoacan these sort of smaller, kind of more community clinics that are more solidly under indigenous control and control of local leaders. At the same time, a very small minority of afflicted people, of people who were sick, ever secured any or went to look for treatment in these hospitals. And of course, ultimately they're a failure in terms of really being able to stop the tide of death. And I look at the hospitals also through a sort of lens of sacrament and sacramentality, and the ways in which the missionaries themselves would sort of, in their effort to care for the sick, move kind of very fluidly between what would appear to be a medical response and then one that's a sacramental response. So in a sense, you can imagine that people experienced medicine as sacrament, right? If it's being, for example, bloodletting is administered with Eucharist, last rites, or even baptism, in sort of, you know, one immediately following the other, that it becomes sort of sacramentalized, and that medicalization within these structures is a form of Christianizing people's bodies, right? That to receive care within these Christian medical establishment was another form of sort of evangelism, and evangelism of bodies.
Yes. this section certainly made me think of sort of the connection between sort of religious actors and the development of Western science and Western medicine, right? We now have this idea that, right, religion and medicine or science are like these separate entities and unentangled, right, which is not the history in certainly in the West, you know, however we want to define that, or arguably in most communities throughout the world. So I think the book did a good job of sort of highlighting the entanglements. So you talk about indigenous survivance, and I would hate to leave listeners with the idea that indigenous populations did not recover after the pandemic. You've already highlighted that in one of your earlier answers. But how did these indigenous populations in Mexico recover, and how did that recovery, like how did it impact sort of religious formation in those communities?
So the final sort of, I would say, culminating chapter of the book is a chapter. So in the first chapters, I focus more on the archival record of Spanish missionary writings and trying to read through those writings to access some understanding of what Mexican experience was in the course of this. But in that final chapter, I work with a series of indigenous authored maps that are produced in the immediate aftermath of this pandemic. So after as the pandemic is coming to a close, the King of Spain basically sends out a survey where every community is to respond as to the state of their population, the resources that are available. So he's trying to map his holdings, right? His lands. And these responses are some of them a very clear window onto how pueblos de indios, these indigenous communities, are understanding their past and their present in this immediate aftermath of this crisis. And along with these surveys, there are a number of maps. These are famous, extraordinary maps that are held now all over the world. There's some in Mexico, there's some at UT Austin, there's some in Europe, in Spain. But they're indigenous authored maps, drawn maps or paintings of communities. So I read these as against the way that they're typically read by art historians or Mesoamerican scholars. I read them as Christian covenants. I think that they are multivalent. They are complex pictographic drawings. They were completely useless to the King of Spain for purposes of rule. I read them as post-cataclysmic covenants in which is depicted a reiteration of indigenous territories and a reassertion of that these are continue to be unceded lands that are under control of indigenous leaders that are empowered by royal lineages that go back generations, and that now these royal lineages and these sacred ancestral territories now encompass not just physical churches, but actually the church itself. And so so I'm reading them as suggesting that in the wake of this particular pandemic, there is a reassertion of these sovereign territories now recast as indigenous Catholic states, and that these territorialities are actually at least as persistent in the history of Mexico as the Spanish vision of a diocese. Now, interestingly, Spanish Catholic missionary dioceses often were forced in any case to align with these territorial entities that were pre-invasion geographies. But the sort of local control over these territories, the reiteration of the territorial boundaries that you see in these maps, and then the clear depiction and representation of indigenous elders or principales who are clearly seen as being an authority over the communities and over the churches within those communities, to me, constitutes a vision for the future of the church in Mexico. And the Mexican church is arguably the oldest Christian church in the Americas. And so it's an original kind of vision that I think continues to really shape Mexican Catholicism today in its practice and ethos.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out that at least the last survey I looked at shows that I think 69% of Latin America considers themselves Catholic. I think the study was in 2010, 2012, somewhere around there. So obviously if the Mexican Catholic Church was the first, their legacy remains not just in Mexico, but throughout the Americas.
Yeah. And my argument is that, and it's one of those arguments that's particularly pronounced when you're trying to make a point, right? You sort of, it becomes even more pronounced. But my argument is that Mexican Catholicism today is really the patrimony of those communities and not the Spanish friars or the bishops or the missionary church.
Right. I think that comes across in your book and certainly relates to my next question. We've sort of alluded to this before, but how do you think your book complicates the relationship between Mexican indigenous peoples and Christianity? You've already alluded to a few ways in which it complicates, but are there other ways? And sort of related, like what were the entrenched myths, as you call them, of the Americas that you sought to dislodge? And they might, you know, those two questions, I think, relate to each other.
Right. I mean, that Christianity is the product of Christian missionaries, of Spanish missionaries, first and foremost, that it's a product of their labor, and that it reflects their desires and their vision. So that's one of those. The other is that Christianity in the Americas, and I think for many scholars of North American religion, that it really begins with the Puritans at Plymouth Rock. And I'm reiterating what we know when we pause to think about history is actually that's quite a bit later after these the period that I'm working on here. And then again, that it's the patrimony of these communities who discerned that there was something retrievable or usable in this in this religion. And I'm trying really to not tell a story that perhaps would seek to kind of redeem that Spanish missionary effort and its imbrication with violent structures, but rather one that really grapples with and recognizes the degree of violence and the degree of and the extent of that colonial cataclysm and its impact on people's lives on the one hand, and then also the reality of the labor and the effort that we see in Pueblos de Indios in trying to actually see that this religion persists in their communities on their terms.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make. Again, my context is in North America and, you know, spending time in New Mexico, the idea that Christianity is sort of the Spanish colonizing faith just rings hollow in many communities, but that can be hard for folks who are not part of those communities and don't know those histories to understand. So I think you did a wonderful job of making that point. So we're getting close to the end, but as I mentioned off air to you, and you know this better than I do, you started the research for this book in 2010, 2011. I cannot imagine that you you anticipated that the COVID-19 pandemic would be in full swing when your book was finally published. So I'm wondering sort of how and in what ways has your research, has this book sort of impacted the way you view the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic?
I think I've been attuned especially to the ways in which it's created this pandemic, the crisis of it, has created possibilities for reconstructing our society in ways that are more just, that the sort of things that can be broken open, attachments shaken loose, and a sense of what else might be possible, but also to see how power also reasserts itself in an effort to deter meaningful transformation or meaningful change. And I feel that we won't know what the impact of COVID-19 is. We won't know what that is for decades and maybe even centuries, because we can't yet see what the ultimate, the things that it may shape or change or set in motion, and how those will ultimately shape the future. And so I think I have that historian's lens of the kind of long durée over centuries. You say, well, I see how in 1576, with this epidemic, they were working so hard to try to understand what this means, why it's happening, how people can survive, or try to understand the causes of it, or the impacts of it. But yet, you know, 500 years later, things that were set in motion, you can see how the course that they ultimately took. And so I just have this sense that we actually don't know yet from COVID-19 how our communities and how the world itself as a historical community will be shaped or defined by what's unfolding right now in front of us.
Yes, you you begin the book by quoting Rebecca Solnit, and your last answer reminded me of her book Hope in the Dark, and the idea that right, we do not know how the future will unfold, even if we think we do, even if we have some indications that it could go in this direction. I think sort of the lesson that historians and others have learned is be prepared to be surprised, because it is so hard to anticipate how, you know, one thing will interact with another and lead to sort of possibilities you didn't imagine. So,
right, exactly.
So we've come to the end of our interview, but I would appreciate if you would read from your book, since we've talked about it. I'd like to put some of the actual words from your lovely book into the ether, into this podcast. So if you wouldn't mind reading the last paragraph of page 176 and the first paragraph, page 177, from your conclusion.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Indigenous communities and their descendants throughout Mexico have struggled to maintain, honor, and tend to the sacred even in the midst of cataclysm, death, and social upheaval. They have sought continuity of practice and persisted especially in their care for the holy, even in its new and problematic Christian guise, where, against all odds, they have often perceived sacred power. Contemporary religious practice across the Americas reflects the pain and paradox of its colonial origins. The church did not emerge unscathed from imperial processes. As we know, it bears the marks, the wounds, or the scars, one could say, of its colonial origins. American Christianity remains in many contemporary articulations an ecclesia ex mortuis, a religion shaped and defined by the ravages of colonial rule. Most of all, by the mortandad in its many forms as it unfolded over centuries. The Church of the Dead continues to haunt American landscapes wherever inherited colonialist modes and mores persist. This is a church that has no future, a church that has been resoundingly criticized and condemned by some. Even as the Ecclesia ex mortuis built its sovereignty on a condition of death, the church also yielded to indigenous preferences, structures, and practices, or rather was compelled to yield, even in times of profound crisis. centering indigenous communities and the historical origins of American Christianity is not a trope to proffer a romanticized portrait that erases, justifies, or mutes colonial violence, or one that resolves or sentimentalizes the struggles of modern indigenous people. Rather, difficulty, complexity, and paradox are ever present, and the colonial cataclysm remains fixed as the primary contextualizing frame in this history. When the history of colonial trauma is retold, too often it is forgotten or ignored the fact that economic, political, and cultural violence was most often perpetuated by those who identified as Christian against other Christians, against indigenous adherents to the faith who nevertheless remained religious others within the structures of colonial rule.
Thank you, Jennifer Shepherd Hughes.
Thank you.
That was my guest, Jennifer Shepherd Hughes, author of Church of the Dead, The Epidemic of 1576, and The Birth of Christianity in the Americas, published by NYU Press in 2021. The book is now available online and in bookstores across the country. This concludes another episode of the New Books in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Until next time.